Hey, thanks for tuning into the show. If you want to support us, go to patreon.com/lastpodcastontheleft.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast
on the left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Legally, I'm not obliged. As are many things that I do. I've been told again and again that I'm legally not obliged to do that.
All right. Well, welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben Kissel. I'm looking at the beautiful Marcus Parks. But to my left, it's an empty space. Where did he go? He's in Atlanta.
Well, yeah, I'm down here in Atlanta, and you know, we made the best barbecue you ever heard in your life.
What accent is that?
That's all from Atlanta. This is the traditional Atlanta accent.
That's brilliant. How's Atlanta going, Henry?
It is seasonable. I'm really enjoying the people. So the other day, so one of my favorite restaurants in Atlanta is this place called Holman & Finch. And it's my favorite place because they do that snout-to-tail kind of cooking where it's like the chef will come to your table and he's like, "We happen to have 4 suckling pigs here today. And we have 2 of their kidneys left, and we like to split them and devil them." And then you just sit at the table going like, "Bring me the kidneys, bring me the kidneys."
God, you just, you eat like Ray Liotta from Hannibal.
I'm looking to die at the table. They had this thing called, it's a pate melt. And it was a burger made out of just nothing but solidified pate and meat mixed in with it, and like a little like burger. And oh God, a bit into it, and it was just like my dick got hard.
We've talked about torture chambers and 9/11, and that's definitely the most horrifying imagery I've had yet, I've experienced yet on this show.
But I'm so sad about David Bowie passing.
That's right. That's what we're. Good God. All right. So that's what we're going to talk about today. David Bowie. Marcus is taking his unbelievable knowledge of music and the macabre and magic, and it's all combined into a great David Bowie episode.
Exactly. This is our David Bowie tribute. Of course, it should come as no surprise to any of you that I'm a gigantic David Bowie fan. Henry's also a big David Bowie fan. Ben, your opinion?
I like him.
See, I think that's the tell of a true David Bowie fan. Instead of you say, be like, "What do you think of David Bowie?" And he goes, "I like him.
I like him." But you know, I'm jealous. He was so skinny. You get the feeling he could have all the food he wanted and he wouldn't gain a pound.
Yes. But you know what, Ben? You'll actually relate to him. Mm. Remember how you lost all that weight?
Working out and healthy diet.
Cocaine and gin and soda.
Yes, that's right.
But yes, David Bowie meant a lot to me as well. It meant a lot to my group in college. It was just one of those things where we would have sing-alongs to Hunky Dory, all that shit. He, you know, gives you an allowance to be weird. I heard him at a young age. It was great. It's like it was a theater kid thing. So everybody was like, "I can be queer all I want to be, but it's still at the same time I kind of just want to kiss Becky." And everyone's like, "You're lame. You're so square," because I don't want to suck a dick. And I understand that. But David Bowie also, besides being a rock legend, was an occult symbol.
He was a figurehead
in and of himself. Yeah. And he lived the life completely.
Yeah, he absolutely did. And before we begin, I'd like to first and foremost acknowledge and highly recommend Season of the Witch by Peter Bebergall. It's one of the most well-written, accessible, and entertaining books on the occult that I have ever read, and I'd recommend it to both magic and music fans. It's all about how the occult saved rock and roll. Mm. That without the occult, rock and roll would have been nothing but a flaccid flash in the pan.
So without the occult, we wouldn't have such great bands as Wasp?
We wouldn't have Wasp. We wouldn't have Poison. Yeah.
Not a single bit of Rat.
Other sources for this episode are the article The Fall to Earth by Peter Doggett and a ridiculously comprehensive piece written back in 1996 by an OTO member named Peter R. Koenig. He had a lot of additional material on the occult matters specifically.
What's OTO again?
The Ordo Templo Orientis. Henry, is that correct?
I guess so. I'm not a Latin person. And I don't mean Latin as in Spanish. I mean Latin as a nerd in high school that's learning Latin because he wants to be difficult.
So our warts and all tribute to David Bowie. And by the way, this is a warts and all tribute. This is not going to be something where we only talk about the good aspects of David Bowie. This really is like he was a very complicated and at times horribly annoying human being to the people around him.
So you mean a traditional magician?
Sounds about right.
Yes, that is how it always goes. But I also think the combination of occult and rock music and any sort of musicianship is a natural marriage because you are projecting a personality out onto a group of people. It's sort of the Grant Morrison idea of chaos magic. And I think it's an interesting idea, like if in terms of when we do our chaos magic episode, this is an example of somebody who truly lived the lifestyle that it takes to be an actual chaos magician and have results, which again, what you're saying, means that you are complicated and annoying. But Grant Morrison sort of believes that artists and writers are the last of the true magicians because you're creating something out of nothing. And David Bowie created personas that he then completely inhabited and created, that we all believed in Ziggy Stardust. We believed that this was this entity. He wouldn't allow it to not be true. So that is the nut of magical belief.
Well, you know, that's why I like Lemmy. You know, he was just dumb enough to always be himself. He wasn't trying to fool me all the time.
Has anybody tried to order a Lemmy at a bar?
No, I have not.
It doesn't work yet.
No.
Jack Daniels is really trying to get the Jack and Coke to be renamed the Lemmy.
Ugh.
They're trying to do it, and I asked for one, and I was looked at like I was an asshole, because I was in that moment.
Yeah, I agree with whoever called you that.
Yeah, but David Bowie, I can say that he was among, if not the most successful magician of the 20th century, if not our entire lifetime. This is what Peter Bebergall said in an interview about him. He said, Bowie's music and performance were a magical practice, maybe even more potent than if he sat by himself in his room and tried to conjure a demon. And this is the point that he's making here. Compare Bowie to, say, like Crowley. Like Crowley, arguably his only point in everything and all of his magical practices was sex and power. Which, and of course, power was tied completely into sex.
Mm-hmm.
But Bowie used magic as a force of creation, not just in music, but also, as Henry said, in the magical avatars that he created specifically from 1972 to 1976.
Mm-hmm. But Aleister Crowley also believed that...
Oh, are you going to do that now? Are you going to do the Crowley thing?
Crowley is how you pronounce it. Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, who yelled at you? Which what asshole yelled at you? That you listen to.
I've been listening to too many podcasts about it. And they always say Crowley. It's like when I was listening to Hardcore History and he kept saying Genghis Khan. And I'm just like, I know.
Yeah.
I know what's proper.
Yeah, I'm going with the Aussie pronunciation.
Crowley, right? Or Crowley? Ooh, that's tough to say.
It is pronounced Crowley. You're supposed to say Crowley, but come on, Mr. Crowley. Doesn't that just feel right?
Yeah, Crowley sounds like a short, stout man who opens the door.
He is.
Thank you, Mr. Crowley.
And by open the door, he meant it in magical terms. He meant force his cock inside of a young boy who thought he was just there for an internship.
Ah. I see.
But what the power aspect of it was kind of like mana and magic cards, if we want to get totally virginal about it, that he was, you build up the power using sex and then you're supposed to do something with it. But Crowley never actually used the power for anything. He just liked the sex and eating cum and eating menstrual blood all the time.
Right. Hungry guy.
Yes. Bowie is an active magician. And the way he harnessed audiences was kind of like how like a Batman villain did it. Are we the Batman villain? Or was it Morgan Freeman in the Batman Begins when he harnesses all the cell phones to find the Joker? Is it Dark Knight?
That's Dark Knight. That's the
second
one.
I'm on 16-hour days in a row. My brain is trash for Batman lore. I'm sorry, everyone who's yelling at the fucking radio right now. He used people in the audience to, because they then believed in him and Ziggy Stardust and stuff like that, is just an example. It made it even more true. It's again the idea of perception meets reality. The perception meets ritual equals reality.
Yeah, David Bowie is possibly the best example of perception meets ritual equals reality.
But I mean, so if the crowd would have rejected the idea, he would have just gone backstage and it would have never he would have never done it again, right?
Oh, no, because you'd just be some asshole in a costume shouting about, like, spiders on Mars. You know what I mean? Like, if he sucked,
Right.
He's probably still had to be a very good musician.
Yeah, right. That's what we must stress again and again, is that he's also one of the best musicians of the 20th century.
Right, and one of the more talented dancers. Apparently, I read one story where all the sound went out in a concert, and he just did mime for 90 minutes, and the crowd went crazy, because so apparently he was the greatest mime.
Can you imagine how much cocaine you must be on to do a pantomime performance for 20,000 people?
I just can't stop thinking of Charles Manson as well, coming on stage with him and just helping him do it.
Yeah. It's just like, I know you're acting like you're in a box, but I can see the box.
David Bowie rising from his mirror.
I'll just mime my way out of this.
It really is. It's almost a superpower in a way.
It really is. The way that he was able to control a crowd, because he also believed in it completely. Like, even up till, you know, very recently, up till the 30th anniversary of Ziggy Stardust that he was supposed to do something for in 2002, he still to that day talked about Ziggy Stardust as a completely different person. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, when I was doing that Ziggy Stardust character, he was like, no, Ziggy Stardust would be very surprised to find out that I turned out to be a rational human being that actually survived this long.
Mm-hmm.
Cocaine. Again, it's just amazing what it does. Well, again, this is the warning. You can't just put silver nail polish on and have like a pants with like a tail built into it and run around and think you're going to change the universe. You have to also learn to play guitar.
Right. And mime.
Yeah. And Bowie, what you also have to do is you also have to be a nerd, because Bowie was also a huge nerd. He was an interpreter of sorts. See, he was a voracious consumer of books, art, theater, and movies, and he was able to use all of these things that he consumed to create both the music that we know and love and the various characters that he inhabited throughout the 70s. And really, with Bowie, it just so happened that in the early to mid-70s, a lot of what he consumed was the occult. And now it is widely accepted by most people that Bowie's first album is not very good. And of course, had this been his only album, almost none of us would know his name. And even Space Oddity, which is still pretty good, mm-hmm. if that would have been all he released, he would pretty much be known as a one-hit wonder.
This is the most record store Marcus you're going to get. If Marcus worked at a record store.
I did work. In fact, I am right now wearing my Ralph's Records t-shirt, which is the record store that I worked at in college.
That's right. Space Oddity. It's pretty good. I mean, have you checked out Space Flattery? Yeah, it's named by this guy named Glavin Rowey. It's pretty good.
It's pretty good. Yeah, this is total record store me. But after Space Odyssey, it's on his third album, 1970's The Man Who Sold the World, that Bowie truly starts to become one of the greatest artists to ever live. And it's also, maybe not so coincidentally, where the occult references start to show up. Mm. Now, his first interest in the occult starts off pretty soft. It's pretty much just on the very last track of the album. Some people argue that the first track of the album has some occult references, but it's a bit of a stretch. But the Superman, he sings, "When all the world was very young and mountain magic heavy hung, the Supermen would walk and file, guardians of a loveless isle."
And again, I'm just here to buy the new Adele album. There's a great song called Hello.
Yeah, I know Hello's great, but if you listen...
It's a pretty good breakup album, but I don't know if you've checked out this album. It's by Robert Palmer. It says, hey, it's "Hey girl, don't you leave. Oh, why are you leaving? Hey, leave. Hey, when you come back, please bring me some eggs." That's the kind of breakup album I think you should be listening to. Adele's just like, everybody's into, so why should you also be into it? I mean, they're just buying into the corporate fucking masters, man.
When I worked at a record store, I took everybody to exactly what they asked for without trying to steer them from somewhere else, because I cared that Ralph's Records was a thriving local business.
That's very nice of you.
So those lyrics that I just read, they hint that it's around 1970 that Bowie probably read a book called The Morning of the Magicians.
Now, The Morning of the Magicians is a must-read book for anybody who wants to be a student of magic. It is outdated. It is very silly. but the core ideas of it are very interesting, and it's more about seeing the train of thought. And Morning of the Magicians is a really good like seed of like the really the beginnings of modern chaos magic and how you can create your own reality by changing your perception.
Is it outdated in the sense that it uses a lot of racial slurs, or is it outdated in the sense that it talks about Nixon?
No, it's outdated in the fact that it's like, you know, the end of all of these books are always being like, and if we just make a drum circle big enough, we can end all the wars.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the right. So it's like, you know, that it just, you can't.
Yeah.
We're not doing it.
Yeah. And it also, it talks about the ancient aliens thing. And it also, it actually predates Eric von Däniken's Chariot of the Gods by about 7 years or so.
Ancient aliens still has yet to be disproved until I still believe.
The burden of proof is on the scientists.
On the aliens. That's where the burden of proof is on the aliens. I say, until we hear their side of the story, I'm not going to say what's truth and what is non-truths.
Absolutely not. So, Morning of the Magicians, the actual book, also contain quite a bit of information about, of course, Nazis and the occult, the Viril Society, and the Thule Society. And this would be a point in time that Bowie's fascination with Nazis could be called almost innocent. It's like Nazi occult life. It would definitely become much more pronounced and much darker later on, just a few years later. But at any rate, Bowie would double down on his newfound interest in the occult with 1971's universally loved Hunky Dory. Like, Hunky Dory is... it's the college album. Like, that's the Bowie album that you listen to in, you know, like when you're about 19 or 20, blows your mind, but it's also one of those albums that stays with you through the rest of your life. Like,
sounds like the album you listen to when you go to a Sadie Hawkins dance. It's a very, Western, Midwestern kind of country name, isn't it?
Hunky Dory. You've never been around a group of people.
No, I have not. I'm not allowed around them. I pummeled a child when I was 7, and they haven't let me be around groups of larger than 2.
So the occult references, and by the way, Hunky Dory starts off with the song Changes. So it could, I don't necessarily think that he was talking.
Changes in the face, great changes.
I fucking love this album. Yeah. And I feel like when we mention these things, you should stop the podcast and listen to one of these songs so you can get back into the fucking mindset.
Actually, if you want, I made a playlist on Spotify that's called Bowie's Occult Songs.
Yeah, Marcus, hell yeah, ancillary fucking content, bro.
But I made that for my own purposes at first because, you know, I had to listen to these songs over and over and over again. I spent about 12 hours listening to nothing but Bowie albums yesterday.
While you and your girlfriend were making death masks of each other?
No, well, we did listen to Low while I had my death mask made until we got to side B when it really starts to get ethereal and weird and deathlike. And that's when I freaked out and had to get her to put on a Talking Heads record.
What's the death mask?
A death...
It's a whole long story. We'll get to it.
Okay. We'll do a whole episode on it.
It's a whole thing.
You know, a lot of couples go strawberry picking. And then you did it. You made a death mask with your girlfriend.
Yes, absolutely.
Huh, different.
Yeah, it was her Christmas gift to me.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Yeah.
No, she really wants you around.
It's like she's planning your death.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing nefarious there.
So the occult references in Hunky Dory start with the second song, Oh, You Pretty Things. But they're still pretty goofy and innocent. You'll remember from our Hollow Earth episode, we talked about a quote-unquote novel called The Coming Race. Now, in case you don't remember, The Coming Race follows a narrator who encounters the Vril-Ya, a race of humans who fled the Great Flood of Noah, lost their way, ended up taking refuge in caverns, and decided to set up shop in the Hollow Earth. The Vril-Ya were masters of the Vril, which was said to be the source of power that pervaded the entire universe and enabled them to influence the minds and bodies of others, gave them the ability to manipulate weather, and also fly. A lot of people say that George Lucas ripped off the concept of the Force from The Coming Race.
All right. Absolutely. A lot of people ripped off a lot of things from the Vril. Also, The Coming Race also remembered everybody that the Coming Race was essentially like the Silmarillion of the Nazi Party, where where it was the organic quote unquote lore, magical lore of the Nazi Party. Mm. So just also remember that.
Yeah, I can't stop thinking of a group of people that just are constantly ejaculating. When you say the coming race, just people walking down the street, like, oh, he's one of the coming race. I'm sorry, we're not hiring coming race people right now. Turns out not good for the coffee shop.
General Zandor, I've been trying to fight in the war, but I just can't. I want to get in the tank and I want to roll over that village, but every single time I get
we want to give you your rights. We want to have you on the front line, but you just can't stop coming.
So, about the Vril, this coming race, this is what the narrator had to say about them.
I pray that ages may yet elapse before they emerge into sunlight, our inevitable destroyers. I have sought it my duty to my fellow men to place on record these forewarnings of the coming race.
And translated to Bowie lyrics, that would be, from OU Pretty Things, they're the start of a coming race. The earth is a bitch, we finished our news. Homo sapiens have outgrown their use. All the strangers came today, and it looks as though they're here to stay. And of course, don't forget about Gotta Make Way for the Homo Superior. So in other words, Bowie was a hollow earth nerd.
I'm here for the miming. Stop with the magic. Can you imagine if somebody watched the mime show and didn't realize that was, you know, not supposed to happen and went to see him live? He's like, this is totally different.
Hey, this rock music is very loud. I prefer the silence of mime. Please, sir, think of the mimes.
Think of the mimes.
So I don't know if to you guys if that makes the song better or worse in your eyes, but you know that's a song that I've been listening to for 15 years of my life, and I just found out about the Hollow Earth thing maybe a year ago, and to me that made the song so much better, and it really opened up David Bowie. It made me see David Bowie in a completely different light.
I had known him as before David Bowie was Ziggy Stardust David Bowie, he was a music theater guy. His first album sort of a soundtrack to a theater show, a live show that he did. And so I always knew he was a nerd. And I also believe that, yes, he has his interpretation. His content came from, like, the Hollow Earth, from the Coming Race book. But at the same time, like, what's the best part about art is you're supposed to take it and you're supposed to put your meaning on it. It's supposed to be about your experience to it. It's like, oh, you pretty things was like a song that my group of friends would sing in unison on mushrooms. Like, this song to me was always about, like, how the world would be a lot better if everybody took mushrooms, man. But also because I was fucking 19.
Right.
I always still believe that.
I agree with you. I always think of that song. I say, all these pretty things. Beautiful voice I have. And I always have that going through my head when I look at puppies in the store. And I love it, and I want to hold them.
So the other song on Hunky Dory concerning the occult, Quicksand, is much more explicit as to what it's about. If you know absolutely anything about the occult whatsoever, Quicksand immediately comes off as full of occult references. The song begins, I'm closer to the golden dawn, immersed in Crowley's uniform of imagery. I'm living in a silent film portraying Himmler's sacred realm of dream reality. And if you listen to the entire song, I think what it's really about is something that me, Henry, and all of you struggle with. That is that magic is hard as fuck.
It's also very isolating.
Yeah.
And the more you talk about it, the more you sound like a fucking crazy person.
Yeah. He continues in the song, I'm sinking in the quicksand of my thought, and I ain't got the power anymore. And the chorus goes, don't believe in yourself, don't deceive with belief. Knowledge comes with death's release.
And to me, just rock and roll.
It's just super rock and roll, yeah. Mm-hmm. And to me, it sounds like that he's given up. He's just resigning himself to the thought that the answers he's looking for won't ever come until he's dead. Again, magic is very, very hard. And
can you also imagine being his producer and at one point just being like, hey, David, love this song, love this song. First of all, you're creeping me out. I wish you'd drop the robe and the wand. But again, it's your life. This is your life. Number two, maybe the Himmler thing, we can take it down from like a 12 to like a 2. Maybe a zero on the Himmler.
No.
David?
you an artist. I love your energy.
No.
I'm just saying the UK, no. Where we're at right now, not even 15 years ago,
no.
Was like leveled by the Nazis.
Absolutely not. No. Well, essential.
Let's do it.
That's the music industry. There it is.
Just spiking a rail. It was great. That's what, every single time you hit that wall with an artist, you just go like, everybody shakes their head and just like, they all just snort. Yep.
And then, not coincidentally, this is about the time that the cocaine comes in full effect with David Bowie.
Not that it ever not was there. It was there in the beginning as well.
Yeah. Right.
It was definitely
there. It sort of taken the pilot seat. After that.
Well, this is the good stuff. This is the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Best cocaine around.
Yeah. This
and
is
David Bowie. Can you imagine being David Bowie's fucking weed dealer? Like, weed or coke dealer?
He actually did not like weed. He said the first time, he hated weed.
Oh.
He said the very first time he smoked weed, I think it was like with the bassist of Deep Purple or something like that. And
the coolest way to smoke weed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he said that he just, like, he said someone rang the doorbell and Bowie went downstairs to see who it was and then got distracted by the cracks on the sidewalk and just followed those for a few miles and then realized he wasn't hanging out with the bass for Deep Purple anymore.
Not a weed guy.
Not a weed guy.
Nope. Following the cracks.
His coke dealer just shown up dressed in a lightning bolt costume and roller skates. And just shows up being like, I just, you know what's funny, man? Is that I didn't even think you wanted cocaine. I woke up this morning and I smelled you needing it.
Yeah. Roller skate, coke dealer.
Well, what Bowie's talking about in Quicksand is that, of course, like, magic is very difficult, and he's having a very, very hard time grasping it. And so he kind of starts taking shortcuts. And as we're going to see, shortcuts in magic are a very bad idea. So after Hunky Dory came what many people, including myself, consider to be one of the best rock and roll albums ever recorded, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. And this album came with Bowie's first character creation, the titular Ziggy Stardust. Ziggy was a bit of a departure from the occult into the space alien sci-fi realm. And during a meeting between Bowie and William S. Burroughs in 1973, Bowie, who completely inhabited the Ziggy Stardust character, said that Ziggy came from a race of alien super beings called the Infinites, who lived in black holes that used Ziggy as a vessel to give themselves a form that people could comprehend.
David, I just can't. I know you're talking about Ziggy like he's a real guy, but I just can't help but think it's a thing you're making up. I don't think I don't mean to cast doubt, but I think maybe you're making him up.
Actually, William Burroughs came right back at him. He countered like, you know what? Actually, I want to open up an institute that will prepare people for the coming race of alien super beings because we're not ready to interact with them yet, but I am totally on board.
You know how that conversation started?
How?
Oh. Wait a second.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? You're right. And at the same time, I think we need to make a cooking class for these aliens so they can learn how to make human food so they can get jobs as short order cooks. Anytime they like.
So, maybe not so coincidentally, Ziggy Stardust also loved cocaine.
What a coincidence.
That is one of those, that's a coinkadink.
That's just one of those things that it's just like, is it a happy coincidence or is it like a meant to be type thing? Is it fate?
Yeah, basketball players like jumping. And Ziggy likes cocaine.
It's around this time that Bowie's legendary cocaine intake really started to ramp up. And with the cocaine came the paranoia. Here's what fellow magic user Aleister Crowley had to say about cocaine.
Give cocaine to a man already wise, and if he be really master of himself, it will do him no harm. Alas, the power of the drug diminishes with fearful pace. The doses wax, the pleasures wane. Side issues, invisible at first, arise. They are like devils with flaming pitchforks in their hands.
Which means eating nothing but peppers and milk for a year.
Absolutely.
God, he definitely sold it. That sounds great.
Now, it's my opinion that Bowie was attempting to use the cocaine to shortcut his way into transcendence, or at least to try to gain the knowledge that he had been trying to reach for the few years previous. And we'll get into later exactly where he got that idea.
I think that it's like he is sort of looking for a shortcut. I also think it's about the confidence that cocaine gives you,
right,
where it's like it's not even just looking for a shortcut. It's that the cocaine makes you believe you have found the shortcut.
Yeah. It's like, I don't have holes in my jeans. My skin is just fighting through.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then it's also like he already had millions of dollars at this point.
Right.
There were many people that were just kind of doing shit for him. So it's almost like magic was working. But he really just had his team of assistants arriving with the plates of peppers and the pitchers of milk that he was eating.
Yeah.
And at some point, he's just like, oh, I just think it. And it comes around because he doesn't realize that after breakfast every morning, after he's had his fucking cup of fucking Colombian coffee, he's like, he just thinks about peppers and milk and he thinks it shows up. But really, he's been yelling about it for 45 minutes.
Right. That's very true. So he took a shortcut with cocaine. It's similar to an athlete using the juice, using steroids, something like that.
Yeah, it's somewhat like that. Yeah, I mean, he took a different path because most people, especially in the 70s, their shortcut was LSD or mushrooms or weed or anything like that. And Bowie went on record. He's like, he said he never liked hallucinogens. He didn't like LSA. He didn't like weed. His thing was uppers because Bowie was also a workaholic. He was also very hyperactive. He had to constantly be doing something. He released an album every single year, and some years released two albums from 1969 until 1980. Like, that is, and they are almost all fantastic. There are a couple of exceptions and a couple of albums that I don't necessarily like all that much. But for the most part, it's a body of work that is unparalleled by any other artist.
I mean, how did he even have time to go to the bathroom? Was he just recording that too? album?
You don't really go much to the bathroom when it's just nothing but cocaine and milk in your system.
I feel like that is the recipe. 87
pounds.
Yeah, but I'm going to have to say I usually agree with 100% with Mr. Henry Zebrowski, but cocaine and milk, that is a recipe for a problem.
No. You get the peppers to even it out.
Oh, God, that is so painful.
And you guys might be thinking we're joking. No, David Bowie survived on cigarettes, cocaine, peppers and milk for like 2 years. And nobody, not even Bowie, knows why he did it. He just fell into it. It's like, well, this is me now.
Imagine what his breath smelled like?
Yeah, I was going to go
close to him.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, he had a lot of women at this time, I would assume, as well. What does that taste like, his magical sauce?
Well, he was married to a woman named Angela from 1970 to 1980, who, and by the way, they did also have a pretty open relationship. Bowie was super fond of the blowjob.
Poor person, though. I mean, that's milk, peppers, cigarettes, and coke.
Can you imagine what that cum tasted like?
Oh, that's what I'm
probably
asking.
Burnt a hole through the tile.
like the alien's blood.
So, no matter what we say, Bowie, what was going through Bowie's head at the Ziggy Stardust time, he was in way over his head. So, 1974 saw the release of Diamond Dogs, which Diamond Dogs does not get enough credit for its completely horrifying post-apocalyptic imagery. The opening track, Future Legend, is an extremely unsettling spoken word piece wherein Bowie talks about how, quote, fleas the size of rats sucked on rats the size of cats.
But he was trying to build up to a rhyme for that.
He got it. He got there.
He got there. And the gayfold cover of the album is an absolute beautiful horror. Shows Bowie as a naked half-dog man, top half Bowie, bottom half dog, flanked by two overweight blue dog women in green bikinis. All three have this weird, bizarre kind of troll hair, red, and all three look like they're ready to kill.
No cocaine involved anywhere in that cover design.
I just want to be the employee at Sears when they show up for the photo shoot. I'm like, what kind of backdrop do you want? We got the tree, we got woods.
I want something that shows the power of stasis and how I am between God and man on a spaceship to Mars.
We got a blue one.
I like the blue.
Oh.
Diamond Dogs marks the point in Bowie's career when the simple and somewhat innocent fascination with the occult that he had used for inspiration on Hunky Dory and The Man Who Sold the World turns into a full-blown, extremely harmful obsession. And with Bowie's status as a world-famous rock star increasing steadily along with the paranoia, it was almost certain that conflict with other world-famous rock stars would occur. And David Bowie found his antagonist in the form of Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page.
Oh.
And if you don't know, and I found out recently that some of you out there don't, Led Zeppelin was one of the heaviest bands of the 70s, particularly the early to mid-70s. And their stock in trade were songs about either fucking or magic, specifically Lord of the Rings type magic.
Right.
Jimmy Page, in particular, the guitarist, was heavy into the occult, and he even went as far as to buy Aleister Crowley's old house, which, coincidentally, burned down just a few months ago. And I'd like to think that Bowie, in one of his last wishes, burned it down himself.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn the wizard's house down.
Right.
He will not conquer me in death.
I don't know.
You meant at the time, because I just can't imagine that Bowie in the 70s while all of that coke is just like, he's just so flimsy that he can't even like strike a match.
Yeah, the match wins somehow. He lights himself on fire.
Now, it was said that Bowie was deathly terrified of Jimmy Page because he believed that Jimmy Page was a powerful warlock hell-bent on casting harmful spells against him.
We've got a nerd alert. It's a post-mortem nerd alert, and it's going for David Bowie.
Can you understand that, like, most people in bands, except for Marcus, are incredibly lazy.
They're
lazy
stunned.
People. They have no drive. They sitting around noodling. Jimmy Page, I'd like to think, yes, he liked to wear a wizard's hat. And yes, he liked to write magic lyrics and stuff like that. But I think one thing that we forget in all of this is that occult teachings and magic writings also just straight up help you get laid.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And that if you want to talk about magic all the time, it helps you get laid by the exact type of people that you want to get laid by, witchy people. You want to meet a hot witchy woman, you got to talk about magic to get them to want to have sex with you.
Yeah,
but that's what Jimmy Page also may have been doing.
I'm going to say the world famous rock star behind the magic discussion probably helped.
Yeah, if you're putting up fucking rebuter parts at right. Radio Shack and you're trying to talk to a woman there being like, sometimes I believe that this realm is just a fold on top of the next. She's just right. Like, I don't even know why I'm in a Radio Shack. I don't need anything from 1992.
Yeah, but if you're Jimmy Page, you can sit and talk about hermeticism, but you can also pause every once in a while to say, play the riff from Whole Lotta Love.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And panties just like literally go, and like seams just shoot out the side, and the pussy just goes like, whoop, and all of a sudden he's just like, he becomes really tiny in his mind, and he's up inside of her.
Do the panties go into the, or out, like an Incredible out. Hulk thing, or sort of a consumption, out. Like a black hole thing?
It's out, and then he's tiny, crawling up her labias, and then going up to the clit and just like it's a fucking speed bag.
Yeah, like a drum solo.
Well, of course, a lot of this is anecdotal type stuff, but I, in my research, found a comment on the website mysticbanana.com titled, "Is it true Jimmy Page tried to kill David Bowie with his magic powers?" That just might refute this. This is what the comment said in full.
Nah, it was never true. JP actually liked having DB around at his beckoning because DB always had the best heroin connections in the States, me. Jimmy was actually so fond of DB and tried to help him out of his paranoia by leaving DB fingernail clippings in a milk carton full of urine for DB to keep in the refrigerator alongside of his own so that DB could have a spell cast on JP if DB found his paranoia to be true. As weird as it is, it sounds today. That is the honest truth from an ex-heroin dealer who was there.
We got some purple stuff. We got some orange juice. We got a gallon piss jug full of fingernails.
Don't you dare touch it. That's my Jimmy Pager, and I used to cast a counterspell if he ever finds my magical elixir.
What kind of apple juice is this? This is a tasty...
Do you like it?
Yeah, I do. I mean, this is very good. God.
Sometimes I wonder why I keep all this urine in the fridge, but then I just...
It's kind of peppery.
And then I know why. I know exactly why.
Well, either way, by 1975, Bowie was in the throes of full-blown cocaine psychosis, which is an actual medical condition. He later said that he was hallucinating almost 24 hours a day during this period, and he always kept a copy of Psychic Self-Defense by Dion Fortune nearby, which describes itself as a, quote, safeguard for protecting yourself against paranormal malevolence.
Hmm. I'm so glad everybody can join me at my house right here. This is my gold record for Ziggy Sardust and Spiders from Mars, and over here, this is just a safeguard for protecting yourself against paranormal malevolence, and over here is the refrigerator where I keep my Jimmy Page urine. Now, if you all please leave!
Leave!
This dinner party is over!
It's kind of strange. The last two things were kind of odd there.
So besides protecting himself from Jimmy Page, Bowie also became convinced that a coven of black lady witches were trying to steal his semen so they could use it to impregnate themselves to create a baby Bowie to sacrifice to the devil.
Now, he might be onto something there. That could that seems actually kind of reasonable.
And being single is hard.
It is. Before Tinder.
He also sometimes switched to believing that the black lady witches wanted his semen for the purpose of building a David Bowie homunculus.
What's a homunculus?
A homunculus is a totem type creation, normally in the shape of a body that is said to, a lot of time in ancient Jewish lore, that you can use it to also called a golem, that you can use this thing to serve, like, it's kind of like a Frankenstein monster, and you can use it either for a magic ritual, like, to stand in place of a person that you're trying to do something for or against in a ritual, or for it to come to life on its own. And I guess... do copycat albums? Is that what they want to do? They think it's going to roll around and steal David Bowie's cocaine?
I just feel like it's a really mean thing to call a tall person in high school. Homunculus.
You're actually pretty lucky that no one's ever called you that.
I know. I don't have any magic friends growing up. They did a lot of coke, though.
So David Bowie in 1975 arrived at what could be called the cocaine capital of the world. In the mid-70s.
San Antonio, Texas. Is that right? Am I right?
No.
Oh.
Los Angeles, California. Ah. And I actually have to take it back. This is where he hung out with the bassist for Deep Purple. That would be Glenn Hughes when he first got to Los Angeles. But he would soon move out of Glenn's house after finding out that he was living just a few doors down from the site of the La Bianca murders perpetrated by the Manson family, which it must be remembered, in 1975, that had only happened 6 years before. And, of course, there had also, you know, another person in the music industry, if you'll remember, Dennis Wilson was heavily involved with the Manson family. So Manson and magicians at that point in time weren't a groovy mix, especially if you're all psychoed out on cocaine.
That's interesting. I would have thought that he might be drawn to it. It's kind of cool, no?
I mean, it's kind of cool. Maybe at a different point in his life you would have been drawn to it. But if you're all gacked out, the thought that an entire family of hippies might come and murder you tends to freak you out a little bit.
Yeah, his paranoia was already at its height.
Yeah.
And all of that just seemed like some pretty heavy, dark vibes, I imagine.
And Helter Skelter was already well known. The entire story of the Manson family at this point was well known. At least Vincent Bugliosi's version of the Manson family was well known at this time. And Bowie was very, very aware of the devil at this point in his life. Mm-hmm. As we'll see with what happened when he moved into his next house. So him and his wife, Angela, ended up buying a house that was formerly owned by the dancer Gypsy Rose Lee, who Bowie discovered soon after moving in had painted a hexagram on the floor of one of the rooms. And after Angela, David Bowie's wife from 1970 to 1980, as she told it, she spent days calming down Bowie after that little incident.
Yeah, I feel like she's really the unsung hero here. She must have been aging like the president. I mean, how difficult is it to be Angela, the wife of coked out, gacked out David Bowie?
But she definitely did not age well.
I'm sure
she
didn't.
This time period, I think, fucked with her pretty hard care to make her who she is now. She's a fucking mess now.
Yeah, but if you read, like, say, if you read Please Kill Me, which is...
That's her autobiography?
No, it's an oral history of punk. It's one of the best rock and roll books ever written. But if you read that book and you listen to some of the people that are sort of behind the scenes, a lot of them say that Bowie wouldn't have made it without Angela. That she sort of steered him in the right direction musically. So after the whole hexagram fiasco, David claimed that he witnessed with his own eyes the devil rising out of their indoor pool one night.
So I'm going to say rich people's problems. Can I just kind of not have sympathy for the guy who imagined Satan coming from his indoor pool? That's awesome.
Yeah. That's all. Yeah. I mean, yeah, because the whole time I've just been like, oh, yeah, finally made it. That's what I'm thinking, like, hell yeah, Satan.
I don't know what it is.
I just noodled on my fucking guitar, like watching him fucking dance on top of my hot tub.
I think I have a dark brain, though, because I watched that documentary, The Nightmare, everyone with sleep paralysis. They looked like great dreams to me. This sounds like an awesome fantasy.
So David, after he saw the devil, decided it was time for an exorcism. He reached out to a woman named Cherry Vanilla, who, it must be noted, was a proprietor of one of America's very first phone sex services, and also one of the central figures of Bowie's main man management company in the mid-70s. Cherry put David in contact with a woman named Wally Elmlark.
And nothing is more reliable than a woman named Wally.
Elmlark.
Armlark.
Elmlark.
Elmlark?
Elmlark, like the tree bird.
Because
she was a white witch?
Yeah, she was a white witch from the New...
Like Bette Midler.
yes.
Oh, that's a white bitch. White bitch.
She was a white witch from the New York School of Occult Arts and Sciences that was located over on 14th and 7th, right over there in Manhattan.
Probably in a goddamn porter potty.
Yeah.
Next to the fucking telephone booth.
And Wally, she was, by all accounts, super groovy 70s gal. She recorded, for example, a spoken word album with Robert Fripp of King Crimson, in which she talked about how spirits from other places took the form of musicians such as Jimi Hendrix, Mark Bolan, lead singer of T-Rex, of course, David Bowie, and Mike Gibbons, the drummer from Badfinger.
Not David Crosby, huh? No Crosby involved.
Same time, you're not saying this correctly, Marcus. In order to correctly say the sentence, it must sound like this.
See, they recorded a spoken word album with Robert Fripp from King Crimson, man. And it was the fucking dopest shit I've ever heard, man. You talk about how spirits from other places, they take the forms of musicians, such as Jimi Hendrix's one. T-Rex dude was one. He was a spirit.
Mark Bolan, right?
David Bowie, of course, he'd suck dick. And Mike Gibbons, the drummer from Badfinger, which at the same time is just like, why him?
Yeah.
I couldn't find out why she thought particularly just the drummer from Badfinger. Who Badfinger's... They're good. Like,
I'm going to say it's one of the worst names in rock and roll history.
Mike Gibbons?
Badfinger.
Oh, Badfinger's fine. That's not Baby Blue's a fantastic song.
I'm saying the name itself. It sounds like a Down syndrome Bond villain. I am Badfinger.
I am Badfinger.
Okay.
I want you to give me a cake, James Bond. I want you to give me a cake so that we can pretend it's my birthday.
Bond, James Bond. Can you find me a better villain? This is embarrassing for my brand.
So in a phone conversation from New York to Los Angeles, Elmlark gave Bowie a series of spells and incantations, plus a list of magical accoutrements that he could use to exorcise his indoor pool of the devil. So Bowie and Angela, whom this account comes from, by the way, set up an old-timey lectern and began the exorcism. Now, Angie, who it must be said, was more than a little skeptical about Bowie's occult dabblings, still had to admit that something strange did happen that night. She said she was totally sober, and she always thought that anything occult was total bullshit and that he was just sort of putting on airs and was, as she said, trying to scare Jimmy Page.
Hey, it turns out, guys, you got a whirlpool. That's actually just, that's a whirlpool. Every time you hit that button, you think it's a light? No, that turns on the whirlpool. So I don't see the possession, but.
This is a hot tub. You guys know that, right?
Yeah. So that's the bubbles.
Come out of it because it's a hot tub. You guys are pretty nude. So once you get clothed, then we can kind of talk about my fee for just coming over here and just confirming that this is a hot tub.
Okay.
So as Bowie performed the incantations, the water in the pool started to bubble violently. Mm. And Angie says, not in the matter that, say, pool jets would create. And when the ritual was over, Angie said that there was a stain at the bottom of the pool that she said reminded her of a gargoyle statue, very sinister. And years later, Angela talked to the property's real estate agent, who told her that no matter what any new owner tried, no matter how many times they tried to repaint the pool, the stain came back every single time.
It's a dookie mark. You'd be surprised how hard it is to come out of the terracotta bottom of a pool. And I will say it does look like a gargoyle form, but only because I got some hold of the client's special powder over here. I don't know what this is, and my balls felt really moist, and so I decided to put it on my balls, but now I'm just seeing gargoyles everywhere.
So those of you who are particular fans of Nazi occult lore might have perked up your ears a little earlier when we mentioned the Vril Society, but you'll be happy to know that that wasn't the only fascination that Bowie had with Nazis and the occult. For around 1973, Bowie got a hold of a copy of The Spear of Destiny by Trevor Ravenscroft. We mentioned this book during our Nazi occult series as one that had me fooled for about its first 100 pages or so before I checked it out and discovered that the book was a complete and total fraud. Mm. If you don't remember, the general idea behind the book is that Hitler was a magically imbued super sorcerer who is obsessed with finding the Spear of Destiny, which bestowed upon those who discovered its secrets the power to rule the world. Now, while I had the power of the internet and the hindsight that living in the year 2016 gives me, Bowie had no such luxury in the early 70s and took the book for a complete and total fact.
I will say, cocaine was the original Google. Yes. You just had all the answers flowing through your head.
It gave you confidence. Yep. It gave you confidence that you were right. He's seen devils in his pool. Again, lips red from pepper residue. Right.
Got dookie gargoyles.
He's reading a lot into everything. I think he would have picked up a menu and he was just like, this is a wonderful book. It's got hamburgers and fries in it. I have a new idea for a concert where I'll dress up as a giant burger and I'll go out to the audience and let them eat me.
I do like that
no,
idea.
No, David, you cannot make a character out of every single piece of paper you read.
So not only is the Spear of Destiny wonderfully bizarre, and if you're really interested in Nazi occult or like alternate history novels, the Spear of Destiny is a fucking hoot, man. It is so much fun.
And let's not call it alternate history. It's just lies.
Yeah,
right?
Alternate history, an alternate a fictional, an historical fiction book is what I would call it.
Ben. It's
yeah, you
a
know
lie
historical
to us.
Fiction. That is an actual literary genre, Benjamin.
I know. It does give it a little bit of gravitas, but I don't.
But again, remember, it is alternate history to us. It is truth in some realm.
That's right.
But no matter how bizarre it is, you can actually see where Bowie may have gotten one or two ideas from it. In the chapter, The Drug-Induced Vision of Adolf Hitler, Ravenscroft described how Hitler, on the advice of a sinister hunchback who ran an occult bookstore in Vienna, took peyote. And with a dwarf named Hans as his trip sitter, Hitler hallucinated a series of past lives that convinced him that he was the rebirth of the villain Klingsor from the Wagner opera Parsifal, which Hitler believed was based on Landulf of Capua, an actual person.
And then, now, we're not saying that this did not happen.
Right.
It may have happened. It could be that when Hitler was living in Vienna before World War I, he may have known a sinister hunchback who owned a cult bookstore. Mm-hmm. He may have taken peyote with a dwarf named Hans. We don't know. But.
Well, if his life was written by David Lynch, then he definitely did.
But supposedly, according to Trevor Ravenscroft, this convinced Hitler through a very roundabout way that I refuse to get into here, that Trevor took about 40 pages trying to explain, that Hitler was the Antichrist. Even though Bowie wasn't into hallucinogens, it is possible that he was trying to emulate Hitler's shortcut to transcendence, because Bowie was obsessed with Hitler for a short period of time. And by obsessed, I mean him and Mick Jagger saw a screening of Triumph of the Will, and Bowie got super into the showmanship of Hitler. And that's what he said. He said about Hitler that Hitler was the first great rock star, that he turned an entire country into a stage show, which he got into a lot of trouble for his pseudo-pro-Hitler stances at the time, because he also said that he was so consumed with the theatricality mm-hmm. of it all, and he was so consumed with sort of the path of the occult knowledge that the Nazis were trying to find that he totally forgot about all the bad things that they did.
Right.
Yes.
Mick Jagger would have gotten into it.
He was really into the fashion.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, he was super into the fashion. And this is also when he's sort of, and that's, of course, at this point, he's starting to ramp up to what is possibly his most fashion-centric character, the Thin White Duke. And the Thin White Duke is the character that he created for Station to Station. And the Thin White Duke is what you become when you eat nothing but peppers and drink nothing but milk and do nothing but cocaine Ooh. For 2 years. Oh, you become a tiny, sliver-thin husk of a human being with the palest white skin that you could possibly imagine.
I just wish I had his confidence.
I know.
I just wish I could have had the support system that he had that just were like, yeah. Every time David Bowie had an idea, they were just like, yep.
Go
you
for
go
it.
Do it. Yo, yeah.
And you know bet, what? David. He was right almost every time.
He was. He was really good at it. He was really good. Again, this is the dangerous thing. Remember, this is in the hands of an artistic genius. He is a genius at doing this. You can't just do it.
Yeah. No, no, don't
you
just
can't
do
just
it.
Walk around and being like, I'm the fat, wide prince. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just walk around and be like, hey, everybody, hey. I sing old polkas, the dirty polkas about how fat my wife is. Like, it's not going to
work.
You're not going to get superstardom.
A good dirty polka might get you some fame. The big for the fat
I don't
white prince.
You can have her. She's too fat for me. She's too fat for me. Hey, she's too fat for me. Hey, I don't want her. You can have her. She's too fat for me.
Hey,
she's fat. She's too fat. She's too fat for me. Hey.
I love it. I can't wait to have a wedding.
So as far as Station to Station goes, it is amazing that Bowie survived the recording of this album. In fact, he doesn't even remember recording it. He was quoted as saying, I know it was recorded in L.A. because I read that it was.
Right.
And if you listen to, when you listen to Station to Station, which I really hope you do after we finish this episode, know that Station to Station, one of the most brilliant albums of the 70s, was recorded in 10 days. Mm. It wasn't like, say, like Television's Marquee Moon, where they rehearsed 10 hours a day for 6 months before going in and recording it over a 2-day period. He just walked into the studio, recorded this fantastic album in 10 days, doesn't even remember doing it, and then just left.
And 3 of those days were spent on his mime tracks, which didn't translate. just didn't translate to the album.
I was making a box.
David, I just don't know if it's an audio medium.
Now I have to start again. I'm supposed to interrupted me.
How long is the track exactly that we're...
As long as I can mime.
Oh, God damn it. More peppers.
So Station
is really blowing through these peppers.
Wow.
Like the Italian grocery next door would be like, I don't understand. How many pallet of pepper we bring in here? Huh? And I try. And maybe an orange pepper? And maybe a green pepper?
No, man, just reds.
Good year for the pepper biz. 2 years of busy, busy pepper business.
Some pepper farmer somewhere. Just like, this bubble's never going to pop.
So Station to Station has some of the most overt references to the occult since Hunky Dory. The Kabbalistic Tree of Life is explicitly referenced in the title track, as well as Crowley's pornographic book of poems, White Stains. Now, I think... It's been a long time since we've read anything from White Stains, not since our Great Beast 666 episode a few years ago. Let's have Henry read a poem from White Stains. This one is called, Go Into the Highways and Hedges and Compel Them to Come In.
Let my fond lips but drink thy golden wine, my bright-eyed Arab. Only let me eat the rich brown globes of sacramental meat, steaming and firm, hot from their home divine, and let me linger with thy hands in mine, and lick the sweat from dainty, dirty feet, fresh with the loss aroma of the street, and then anon I'll glue my mouth to thine.
That's kind of a nice poem. You got the vomit noises in the poem, huh?
I'm sorry. Tell me, young Arab, what rhymes with
maybe like a something like that?
I will say my favorite two lines of any poem are the rich brown globes of sacramental meat, steaming and firm, hot from their home divine.
He's eating shit in that, right?
Yeah,
or
yeah,
a roast beef.
That's exactly what it is. Rich brown globes. He's eating little dookie balls, steaming and firm, which that means they are fresh and the man has eaten his fiber, hot from their home divine, meaning the asshole is what Aleister Crowley sees to be a holy place.
David Bowie ate dookie?
No, Aleister Crowley did.
Oh, we know that's a fact.
But we also don't know that David Bowie ate dookie. He did hang out with Lou Reed a lot.
And Lou Reed ate dookie?
Well, Lou Reed liked to have the plate glass done.
Ah, the De Niro.
Yeah. Yeah, Lou Reed liked to have the plate glass done. And Lou Reed also did like to shit in mouths. Would very casually just walk up to him and was like, hey, you want to go back to my hotel room and I'll shit in your mouth? And if they said no, he'd say, like, cool, and walk
cool,
away.
Cool, all right.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. Well, I guess you
can't help but can't blame a guy for asking.
No, you cannot. Dookie King.
So at any rate, the song Station to Station is essentially the coke-fueled roadmap of Bowie's misadventures in the occult. The line, you drive like a demon from station to station, coupled with the line, one magical movement from Kether to Malkuth, tells you that he realized by the time Station to Station came out that he went too far, too fast, and fried himself in the process of trying to find some occult knowledge. Because Kether to Malkuth, Kether, it's either Kether is the high, I think it's Kether is the crown of the Kabbalistic tree of life. It's the top. Malkuth is the bottom, the earth. And when he says one magical movement from Kether to Malkuth, he means that he tried without really doing anything in between to go from the bottom to the top and completely fried himself in the process. He was saying that
because you're supposed
he did it
to, it's
wrong.
It's supposed to be take years of prep.
Yeah.
It's years of meditation and considering the chakras and doing all this. You're supposed to go through it stage by stage by stage. And if you just try to coke your way through the Kundalini line, you're going to come out sounding like a jackass.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you're going to come out the thin white duke, a husk of a man, like an absolute husk of a human being. Which he's at the end, by station to station, Bowie's at the end of a fruitless journey, but still trying to understand pictures that were taken that were used as the back cover to a later release of Station to Station show Bowie wearing black and white striped clothing sitting on the floor sketching the Kabbalistic tree of life. And it's this picture that connects Bowie's failed sojourn into the occult in the 70s with David Bowie's very last video, Lazarus, and his death soon after its release last week.
Now, so, between the Station to Station and Lazarus, we know David Bowie went through nine other like permutations. He did like the industrial thing. He was like, he did a bunch of dance albums. He did a bunch of stuff. He became much more normal. Him and he married Iman.
Well, yeah. I mean,
some beautiful kids.
Well, not until, right after Station to Station, he recorded the Berlin Trilogy.
Which is awesome.
Which is amazing.
Low is awesome.
Heroes, Lodger, and then he followed that up with Scary Monsters, which is also amazing. And then it's 30 years of pretty mediocre stuff.
Oh, he found love.
Yeah, with Iman, yeah, and like I think he married Iman in like the early 90s or something like that.
He did good.
He did good.
He didn't have to do more than he already did. And I think that's a thing to do. It's just like he had already made his mark. And at that point, you're making music because you like to make music.
Yeah.
But and then because Heroes, the Berlin Trilogy, then just kind of feel like he's just a really good musician. He was a beautiful musician who knew what he was doing, and he didn't. He kind of dropped some of the really extreme viewpoints of his younger career.
Well, he was coming off of cocaine with Low. Low is the follow up to Station to Station. He's coming off of cocaine. At least it's his first attempt to kick cocaine. Of course,
yeah,
never
it was him and Iggy Pop got together because him and Iggy Pop were really close.
Well, it was more him and Brian Eno with Low. Of course, Brian Eno was in Roxy Music. He produced the three best Talking Heads albums and produced one of the best albums of the 70s, Here Come the Warm Jets. But if you listen to Station to Station,
Here Come the Warm Jets?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like that's what the guy who shits in mouse.
Alistair Crow. Lou Reed.
Yeah, Lou Reed. Here comes the Warm Jets. We're fighting for that poor woman, you know.
Here come the Warm Jets.
How was your time with Lou? How was the date?
Brown
date.
But if you listen to Low, Low. The first habit, like side A, is they're fantastic David Bowie songs like Sound and Vision, keep crashing in the same car, but side B is mostly instrumental, and to me it sounds like a transition between one part of his life and the next. Is the first part, that what he had been doing the last like 4 or 5 years, that he had kind of been working towards this sort of. Working towards this knowledge, trying to find some sort of hidden secret knowledge. And then with Station to Station, he admitted that he failed, that he hit a brick wall, he almost died, and he had to start over. And side B of Low, to me, really sounds like he's moving forward, but having no idea where he's going next. He has absolutely no idea what's in front of him, but he's still walking forward, which I think is something that Bowie took to the very end of his life, which brings us to Black Star. So for the last year or so, those of us who follow stuff like this have heard the cancer rumors about David Bowie. When he died of cancer, it was definitely, it affected me, but it wasn't a shock because...
But did I tell you that Kristen Milioti on A to Z is in Lazarus, his new musical, and she's been working with him for the past 3 months, and she was saying how he... I asked her, I was like, is he sick? Because I heard that he was sick. And she was like, well, he's here every day,
yeah.
And he works really... He's been working like crazy. He had limited hours, and he sometimes came in looking like he had just come from treatment, but mostly it was like... What you're going to find is that he had had a full revamp creatively. He had come back over the last year and out of nowhere, when he got the terminal diagnosis of his cancer, and he said this, is that it's like he had that purpose kind of click back in,
yeah.
Where he was like, I know what to do now. It's a full sweep back to my occult leanings. And Lazarus was a big step in that. And she also said he had crazy sneakers and smelled really good.
Hey, all right. Good to hear.
Yeah. On November 19th, of last year, Bowie released the video for Black Star. and anybody who had heard the rumors and also anybody who was kind of interested in Bowie's occult leanings, as soon as you watch Black Star, it's pretty much he's going to die in 2016. Because if you haven't watched the video, it's absolutely beautiful, goofy at times, like the seizure dancing
is like, give me pretty fun.
Black man, white man, little girl shake. it's really weird, but the overall concept of the video is absolutely beautiful. So the first thing that you see in the video is a skeleton in a spacesuit, which harkens back to his first hit, Space Oddity.
Mm.
You know, Major Tom, all of that. And then when
which is very interesting, because then it's him going back to his own, that what Grant Morrison we talk about is just creatively creating these avatars for yourself. A Major Tom was probably his first real like symbol of himself as this sort of man lost in space. And then Black Star is where Major Tom goes.
Yeah.
He ends up on Black Star. And then we see when you cuts this the astronaut's body with this head, it's the skull headed that's bejeweled, covered in jewels, much like the dead Catholic saints in display in churches across Eastern Europe. And he's putting himself as like Saint Bowie.
Yeah, and that's not a far stretch. Mm-hmm. He is self-aware. He knows that after he dies, people are going to freak out.
Yeah.
He's going to be sanctified. He's going to be beatified. Like, David Bowie, as long as people are talking about music, David Bowie will come up. And then after you get the spacesuit, the skeleton in the spacesuit, you see the bandages covering his face, which really is, in both Black Star and Lazarus, is, I think, the creepiest image of them all. Because he's got these bandages over his eyes, and he's got these tiny black buttons where the eyes should be. And I think...
Because also, it's an ironic self-expression of the idea of, like, blind prophet who paints eyes. It's like, this whole time you've looked at me as if a person who knows what's coming in the future, but I don't. And you view me as, and so in order to portray that, it's like, I am blind, but I draw this symbol of eyes on me that you've done,
yeah.
You've made me do, because now you look at me and you believe that I have the fucking secret, but I don't have the secret because I don't fucking know, man. I don't know what's gonna happen, man.
Yeah,
nobody knows.
I mean, Black Star is, he is terrified. If you watch these videos, he is not going gently into death. He's going into death not knowing what is coming next, and
right.
He is admitting to everyone that he has no idea what's coming next. And
well, his producer said the same thing. He only had, when he came in, he only had several images in mind, and one was the crystal. It was Major Tom. He name checked Major Tom, and the other one is he wanted a lot of scarecrows.
Yeah,
and I don't know if that's just because he thinks scarecrows are cool. Because when I first watched Black Star, I didn't know he was just about to die. I watched it and I was just like, David Bowie's doing something. And I was just like, well, it's got to be cool. It's got to be right because it's David Bowie. And this is what he obviously, whatever he wanted this to be, is exactly what he wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
You can never go wrong with a scarecrow. Out of ideas, use a scarecrow.
Well, it's also with the scarecrow. There's also three scarecrows. It's a reference to the crucifixion, to Golgotha. Another occult reference. So those same bandages with black buttons link Black Star to his final video that came out just 3 days before he died, Lazarus. One thing you might have noticed in that video were the strange black and white clothes that Bowie was wearing. And if you look back to the pictures of Bowie during the recording of Station to Station, where he's sketching the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, he's wearing the exact same clothes. And I think that Bowie, late in life, when he was facing death, returned to the occult studies that he had failed at so badly in his youth, and it could be that it was only at the end of his life that he could truly understand that, like he said in Quicksand in 1971, knowledge comes with death's release.
Oh my God.
Fuck yeah, and rock and roll never dies.
Powerful.
And it really does. It really doesn't. And he will live on always because of what he meant to so many people. And the occult thing aside, like, just this, besides the symbolism, is that the reason why he is the most successful magician of all time is because his creations will live forever. And it's showing that it's that thing about art, is that's all you need. That's where the magic is. The magic is in creating something that wasn't there before and living it and never looking back. And he, I don't know, it's kind of beautiful. It's incredible. He's in history now forever.
Yeah, it is a beautiful life. It is almost a perfect artistic life. It's insane that this man was able to, at the end of his life, he didn't die in a dumb heroin overdose. He didn't die in a car crash. It wasn't sudden. It was almost like he was ordained to do this. Like he was allowed to do this.
Wow.
But yeah, rest in peace, David Bowie. It's I don't know.
All right. Amazing. What a informative episode about a musical genius and an artistic genius all around.
Yeah. I mean, that's what
he
always says.
See you on the other side, Bowie.
See you, man. That's what he always says, that he never considered himself a musician. He considered himself an artist who used music as a medium.
And I will say, a lot of people do want to see Bowie on the other side, but you didn't see him in real life, so you probably won't see him there either. He's busy. He's in, like, a special park, you know? He's just, like, being, like, really cool.
Yeah, he's in the VIP section.
Yeah, you're still not going to meet him. Yeah. So it doesn't, yeah.
Tell me, Beethoven, do you have peppers here?
Oh, my God. Yeah. All right. What a great episode. Great research, everybody.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Rest in peace, David Bowie. And I'm going to go back on that diet of his.
You gonna
peppers, milk, and Coke. It's going to be big. Let's see. So what do we usually do at this point in the show?
If you guys...
Say hail Satan to everyone.
Yeah.
That's right.
And if you guys want to donate to our Patreon campaign, thank you to everybody who has donated so far. Go to patreon.com/lastpodcastontheleft.
Mm-hmm.
And you can donate however much you like. I hope everybody is enjoying the first shipment of bones that are coming in the mail.
Absolutely. And Henry, you were saying that you wanted to yell at all the listeners for not watching Heroes Reborn.
Yes. You did this. You did this. You
not the Canadian staff. The Canadian grips. But your how's your pretty face going? Everyone wants an update on that.
We're fucking crushing it. Third season's going to be the best thing we've ever done.
Wonderful, man. Can't wait.
Shit.
Awesome.
Oh, and
I am starting to include things on the Patreon campaign as well. That's coming up. I guess I will. I'm doing readings of the Satanic Bible, which is filling me with juice.
Yeah? What kind of juice?
Come. I think I'm making love better since.
Yeah, well,
read the Satanic Bible.
Let it out, though. You got to let it out. Don't want to keep it all in there.
No. The pillows in this hotel room are live in fear.
Ugh. Ever since I'm reading the Old Testament, and ever since I've started, I've been a lot angrier.
All right. Very good.
Yeah. If you read in the God voice enough, it starts to seep into your real life.
Oh, that's exciting. I think I want to read something about duck hunting. I watched something on that the other day. Very difficult to hit a duck.
It really is. You can read whatever you like, man. Yeah. It's Ben's choice.
Yep. So duck hunting, or maybe I'll just eat a couple of muffins. Describe those.
And if you guys want your very own Last Podcast on the Left t-shirt, go to cavecomedyradio.com/merch. And while you're at cavecomedyradio.com, listen to some of the other shows that me and Ben do together, Abe Lincoln's Top Hat and the Roundtable of Gentlemen, and a couple other shows that I do with Henry's sister Jackie, Page 7, and Sex and Other Human Activities.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go ahead and... Oh, and also don't forget, this Saturday, January 23rd,
yes, that's right.
We have our next Last Podcast on the Left live show. We've got Hold McNeely from the Roundtable of Gentlemen sitting in for Henry while he's in Atlanta. And don't forget to join the Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at LP on the Left.
Perfect. And I'll tell you, man, these CCR shows are crushing. If you look at the iPhone.
Tunes.
The iTunes. You look at the iTunes list. I mean, it's just nonstop CCR.
Yeah, man. We've got like three or four.
Even more than that, I'm telling you. Yeah, it's nuts. This Week in Jackin's been on there. I mean, Marcus, you've done such a great job with the network.
Hey,
good
man,
job.
I couldn't have done it without all of you guys. Otherwise, I'd just be some asshole in a room talking about David Bowie by myself.
Oh.
Yeah, so thank you guys for doing this with me.
That's right.
This has been a beautiful experience. Everybody who's donated to this campaign and to Patreon, it's kind of overwhelming. It's pretty fucking cool, and thank you so much. 2016 is going to be a fucking year filled with satanic beautiful devilry.
It's going to be a great year. Yes, thank you guys so much, and hail yourselves.
And oh my God, I just checked the Patreon campaign. We're at $5,900. If we get just $100 more, the three of us are going to do a live Google Hangout with every single Patreon supporter, in which we'll answer all of your questions live.
Awesome.
So, we just need 100 more bucks for that. So go to patreon.com/lastpodcastontheleft and help us get there.
Yeah, and speaking of live, feel free to stop by the Creek in the Cave every Sunday. We usually record Roundtable at 6:30. We love having people come and watch the show. It's a really fun time to meet the fans and hang out.
Every week, you guys are more than welcome to come.
All right, hail me as well.
Yeah, and hail Gee. Hail Bowie.
Oh, yeah, hail Bowie.